Instead of beginning our message this morning with reading Daniel 3 during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, I'd actually like to start about 850 years earlier, long before the children of God found themselves enslaved to Babylon. They were first enslaved to Egypt. And God graciously drew them out of that bondage and led them to the base of Mount Sinai. And although they were rebellious at that time, if you remember, they built a golden calf and they worshipped it. Instead of striking down that nation in his wrath, God gave them mercy. But that mercy came with commands. The voice of God thundered down from the top of that mountain and said, "I am the Lord your God, which has brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that it's in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them." This is the primary command of the Creator God, that He alone is God and He alone ought to be worshipped. Any other object of affection is to worship what is created instead of worshiping the Creator Himself. Of course, you know, throughout history, the nations rejected God and they worshiped idols. Even the nation that was called Israel, called to be the people of God, rejected and rebelled against His command. Not everyone, never everyone. In every generation, there was always a remnant of people who loved God and was loved by Him and were called by His grace and preserved with His mercy. And although there were always people of God who, though the world around them fell into decay and decline, they could always be pointed to and said that they're the ones whom I've preserved, that never bowed down their knee to these idols. And so, fast forwarding to about 125 years before our text in Daniel 3, as it becomes clear that the nation of Israel as a whole would suffer God's wrath, the prophet Isaiah was sent with a message. He was sent, and part of his message in Isaiah 43 was to those who would not bend their knee to idols. This is what God told them in Isaiah 43, the first few verses. "Thus saith the Lord that created you, O Jacob, and He that formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine. And when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior." Now, can you just tuck those two thoughts away in the back of your mind as we read this? You're to have no God except God. No molten metal or gold-plated playthings are to be taking the place of the true Creator God. And if you worship God, the Creator God, the Savior God, the Holy One, the one true God, if you stick with Him, He'll stick with you, whether it's through flood or whether it's through fire. The water's not going to drown you, He said. The fire is not going to consume you, because He is your Savior. Now, remembering that, let's read Daniel 3. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent together the princes and governors and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, the dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falls not down and worships shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falls not down and worships, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded you. They serve not your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not you serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if you be ready, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, if you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 17 times more than it was wont to be heated. He commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spoke and said to his counselors, "Did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they answered and said unto the king, "True, O king." And he answered and said, "Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose body the fire had no power, nor was a hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, though the smell of fire had passed on them. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. By God's grace, we're going to break this down into four basic parts. The first part occurs when the king issues a command in the first seven verses. If you wonder what depths of depravity a man may sink, then just remember that in Daniel chapter 2, just before this, Nebuchadnezzar had had a dream of a massive idol, and that, you know, that Franken idol had many parts to it. But Nebuchadnezzar was told, "Well, you are that head of gold." And he was told each part represented a kingdom, successive kingdoms to rule the earth until a final kingdom comes. That gigantic idol was smashed to bits by the arrival of the Son of God himself. And so, what does Nebuchadnezzar do with this dream and this revelation? Does he align himself by faith with that future kingdom-crushing, idol-destroying Son of God? Right? The one who has come to demolish all of the ignorant idols of human ingenuity? No, Nebuchadnezzar decides, "I should really build that idol of my dreams. But you know what? I should make that head of gold maybe just a little bigger. Maybe make the whole idol of gold." Right? This is a tribute to the stark stupidity of human arrogance. And this, of course, is not the first time such a thing happened. It isn't even the first time that that kind of thing happened here. Right? Where is here in the text? Where are they at? Well, look at verse 1. He set up this idol, it says, in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Can you remember anything else in the Bible that happened on the plains of Babylon? Can you hear an echo of Genesis chapter 11? Right? Everybody, come here. Let's make a city. Let's make a tower that stretches into heaven so that we can make a name for ourselves. And now somewhere in that same plain, generations later, the message is, come on, everybody, look at this massive statue that we have erected, an unwavering tribute to our own glory. In fact, in that first example of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, it resulted in a division of languages, a breaking up of people into nations. But now this idol of Babylon is supposed to fix that. Look at verse 4. Right? This is going to unite all the people and nations and languages. Or look at verse 7, where all the people and nations and languages are to fall down in unity and worship this idol. This Nimrod Nebuchadnezzar is hardly as original as we give him credit for. Now, there's a lot that we do not know about this story, and I want to be clear about that. For example, there's somebody missing from this story, and we don't know why. We don't know where Daniel is and what's taken him away. Maybe he's away on government business. But we really don't know. And there's also things about this golden idol we don't know. We can't say with certainty if this is an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself or whether it is a representation of one of the Babylonian gods like Marduk or Nebo. We do know that the dimensions are quite impressive. It is very tall and very thin. It's 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. And for this time, erecting a statue that stands 10 to 12 stories high, it's more than a little impressive. It's virtually unheard of, especially if it's made of solid gold, or even if it's plated in gold, which is very likely. We're talking about a huge expense. This is something that would have threatened to drain the king's treasury, and so there's probably more than just a little political interest in this project, too. This is not all about religion. So Nebuchadnezzar issues a call to the entire empire, right? We're not talking about just local dignitaries, but representatives throughout Babylon are expected to arrive for the, verse 1 calls it the dedication, the grand unveiling of this statue. The chapter is written with some excessive repetition. You might have noticed as we read through it, there's several things that get repeated several times to kind of draw our attention to the kind of pomp and circumstance that's involved here. For example, you can look at verse 2 or verse 3, and you see the princes and governors and captains and judges and treasurers and counselors and sheriffs and provincial rulers, right? The gang's all here. Everybody who's somebody shows up for this dedication ceremony. It's like Nebuchadnezzar's plan is to say, well, if all the leaders bow down to this image, that sends a message out to all the people that they have to bow down to this image. And the choreography is all planned out. Look at verses 5 or verse 7 or verse 10 or verse 15, right? The Babylonian Symphony Orchestra is called. There's a cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, all kinds of other music. I actually did a little study on each one of those, and I am not going to bore you with all the details, but none of them are really instruments like we use today. There's a horn section and a flute and a lyre, an instrument that's like a harp. There's drums. One of them even describes a wonderful device that's probably the closest that we know to it is bagpipes. Suffice it to say, Nebuchadnezzar is proud of himself. So there is this sort of red carpet gala event. When the celebration begins and the orchestra starts playing, the proclamation has been issued. It's time for you to get on your knees. And this is more than just a test of devotion to that idol. It is a patriotic display of your love for Babylon, your allegiance to the king himself. Right? If you don't assume the position when the music starts playing, you can't imagine the kind of anger you're going to get. Verse 6, whoso falls not down in worship shall the same hour be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And so you would expect, with all the peer pressure of these dignitaries and the added threat of disobedience to the king himself, there was widespread, almost uniform compliance. In verse 7, when the Babylonian Symphony Orchestra starts playing, everybody gets down on their knees. They fell down with their noses in the dirt, and they worship this ignorant idol. Well, almost everybody. Because we've seen the king issue a command. Let's look at the wise men issue an indictment in verses 8 through 15. Actually, just look at verse 8 and then verse 12. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. In verse 12, there were certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded you. They serve not your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. Look at that word accused in verse 8. It actually comes from a root word meaning to eat or to devour. It's actually a common phrase back in the culture of the day. literally what it says in the text is they ate their pieces. And that might seem odd to us, but we have phrases like, well, you got chewed out. Except this is something far more violent, far more rage. The Chaldeans, meaning either the local native Babylonian officials or the wise men in general, they show up angry and they want to sink their teeth into these Jewish men. Perhaps they resented the rise of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Hope you don't mind if sometimes I refer to them by the names that they would have preferred. These wise men have maybe a long-standing grudge after not being able to interpret the king's dream. Maybe these Chaldeans are just anti-Semitic in general and hated these Jewish men just because they were Jewish. But they're strategic in their approach. In verse 9, they come with buttery words, right? Oh, king, live forever. Right? You made this all gold idol as a statement that you're not going anywhere. We sure hope that's the case. But what's the point in ruling forever if your subjects don't obey? We really hate to say it, but you know those stubborn Jews and their invisible God. It's a problem. You brought in all these dignitaries from throughout the empire of Babylon, but these three men who you've put over the affairs of Babylon, they won't bow down. In this case, the writer is actually repeating himself again. There is a stress on this phrase about the idol that the king set up, or that Nebuchadnezzar sets up. You'll see it in verses 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 12, 14, and on it goes. There's this constant repetition of that. Each of them refer to this idol by saying, well, Nebuchadnezzar has set it up, and this monstrosity is of Nebuchadnezzar's making. And the reason the writer, I think, is saying it like that is because the very ridiculousness of that idea. The original Jewish audience reading this would have seen the mockery in that phrase, that this is an idol that the king set up. We know the concept of setting up has been used before in this book. In the first two chapters, we learn that God had set up Nebuchadnezzar. Right? God is the kingmaker. So just how ridiculous is it that the king now wants to be the God maker? The very idea that we could make our own gods is ludicrous. One of the most sarcastic passages of Scripture, and I love it because it's so sarcastic, is from Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20. And I'm not going to make you turn there and read it, but let me just sum it up for you. Foolish people make foolish gods. What other kind of people that a fool would make his own god? It uses the example and says, well, look, a blacksmith slaves over a hot forge to pound and to hammer and to shape an idol. But that idol is powerless to help the blacksmith when he becomes tired and thirsty from the work. Or a woodworker can measure and cut and trim and chisel. But they can only do that if they cut down one of the trees of the true God's creation first. And so he goes out and he cuts down a tree and he uses part of that to make an idol and say that this is my God. And he uses another part of that tree to start a fire in order to cook his dinner. Boy, I hope he doesn't burn the wrong part of the tree. It's only foolishness, stupidity, and ignorance that would say a person can create their own creator. And what Isaiah says is in the end, they have an idol that can do nothing to help them. But they never stop. Isaiah says they never stop and look down in their hand and say, isn't this thing that I'm holding nothing more than a lie? That's what the writer is saying here in Daniel 3. He keeps repeating, this is an idol that the king had set up. It doesn't matter if it's a blacksmith or a woodworker or a king. Anything we set up is foolish and powerless. But now watch as the wise men use that same phrase, remembering all those uses of that term. Look, this is what the king has set up. Keep that in mind as you read their accusation in verse 12 when they start talking about these Jews whom you have set up. You get what they're saying here? How is anybody going to believe there's power in that God you set up when you don't even have a power over the people that you set up? They're saying, look, those Jews over there, it isn't just that they're passively refusing to worship an idol. They are actively mocking the king. But the problem is that Nebuchadnezzar, in his mind, he already knows. He knows this idol is powerless and deserves no praise or no glory. Listen to what he says in verses 14 and 15. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do you not serve my gods, nor worship the image which I have set up? Now, if you be ready at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, if you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if you worship not, you will be cast the same hour in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Now he asks a question in verse 14. He's like, is this accusation true? And we don't get any response of these three men to that question. It just goes straight into verse 15 where Nebuchadnezzar surprisingly offers them a second chance. But do you understand what he's saying there in verse 15? Look, I'm going to have the orchestra play again. And if you assume the position, great. If not, it's the furnace for you. And who is the God that can deliver you out of my hands? And so let me ask with that question, does Nebuchadnezzar believe in divine power? No, not even a little bit. He denies divine power in his own gods or in their God, right? There is no God who can deliver you out of my hands, right? He's looking at them saying, boys, make no mistake. This isn't about any gods. This is about me. Which, by the way, me is what idol worship is always about. Paul in the New Testament describes it as worshiping the creature rather than the creator. And so before you think that a passage like this is not relevant to you, understand that anything that challenges your affections and obedience to God alone is an idolatry level temptation for you. For example, Colossians 3:15 tells us that covetousness or greed is idolatry. Not just greed for money, although that fits, but any selfish desire for anything is idolatry. John Calvin once wrote that our hearts are idol factories. We're continually producing false gods which challenge our affection for the true God. You know, we don't today make golden idols and set them up in the middle of the plain and tell people to worship them. We make our gods today out of pleasure or wealth or health or popularity. We have gods of power and security and sex and politics and family and pride and entertainment. There is a never-ending list of counterfeit gods that we make for ourselves. We make idols of relationships or idols of good grades or idols of sports teams. John Piper said, you can make an idol out of having the nicest lawn in the neighborhood if you come to love and serve that more than you love and serve God. Listen, if any of those things challenge our devotion to God. When we give into that temptation, we have bowed down. Our noses are in the dirt. And when we're bowing down to some self-serving idol and not giving ourselves fully in submission to God, we have failed to stand as these three Hebrew men stood. And I know we can argue, oh, well, but our idols are nothing like the statue, as if that makes it better. That we acquiesce to some lesser idols is nothing to brag about. And so look at your own life and ask yourself, what is it that you're holding on to so tightly that it prevents you from loving God supremely? Because it holds some of your heart and some of your soul and some of your mind and some of your strength when you are to love God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength. Whatever you're holding on to that causes you to lose your grip on God, folks, you need to look at your own hands and acknowledge, isn't that thing I'm holding nothing more than a lie? Now listen as these three Hebrews issue a response, starting in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto you, O king, that we will not serve your gods nor worship the golden image which you have set up. Look, we have to strike the appropriate sort of passiveness or aggressiveness when we analyze these three men. They were not looking to get into the king's face. That's not how they started this day, seeking a confrontation. You remember the king actually didn't even notice that they weren't worshiping until some Chaldeans came and told on them. It seems like they just quietly refrained, but when they are brought to the king, they do not hesitate and they do not equivocate. They speak boldly and clearly. When they say in verse 16, we're not careful to answer you in this matter, they are not saying, right, we're going to answer you carelessly. Because I assure you, nobody's going to stand in front of the king of Babylon without choosing their words carefully. What verse 16 means is we don't need to spend time craftily wording a response. We're not going to be crafty. There's no need to defend ourselves. There's no need for debate or consideration. Worshiping that statue, it's a deal breaker. It is a non-starter. It is non-negotiable. We don't need any time to craft a carefully worded response. We already know we are not worshiping that statue. As for the rest of it, essentially they say, you ask what God can deliver us because you think there's no God that can, but you're wrong. The God that we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. Look at verse 17. He says, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, you need to know, we're not going to serve your gods or worship that statue. Look, I don't want to pass over this because actually verses 17 and 18 is the only place in this chapter where the people of God have a chance to make their voice heard. So note three things specifically that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah have to say about God. First, God is able to save them. Our God is able to deliver us, they say. They're standing in front of the most powerful man on earth, and they are confident that God is more powerful. Right? Staring down this threat of embarrassment and pain and death, they know God's able to deliver them from those. Listen, my friends, whatever you're facing, God is greater. He is able to deliver you. But these men of faith do not have such a simplistic faith like the prosperity gospel that says, well, God has to do what I want, because look at the second thing they say about God. While God is able to save them from the fiery furnace, he might not do it. They say in verse 17 what God can do, but in verse 18, it shows they have no presumptions about what God will do. They say, if not, right? Oh, God can save us, but if not, he's able to save us because he's God, but if he doesn't, he is still God. Listen, if God was only some genie in a bottle, all we would do is rub the lamp and give him our wishes. But you and I need to have the same kind of confidence as these three Hebrew men do. Whether he grants our desires or in his wisdom withholds from us what we want and allows us to suffer, it shouldn't compromise our commitment to him. And thirdly, I want you to see, they say God's able to deliver us. They say he might not deliver us. But in between those two statements, you know what they say? Yeah, he's going to deliver us. Look at verse 17. God's able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Now, how do we make sense of this? Of them saying, well, God can deliver us, God might not deliver us, and in between them saying, yeah, he's going to deliver us. Well, understand, what they're saying is God will deliver us out of your hand. He can deliver us out of the burning fiery furnace if he wants to. But whether we go into that furnace and burn, or whether we go into that furnace and come out alive, either way, he's delivering us from you. This is in God's hands. It's not in Nebuchadnezzar's hands. It's also a certainty that whether they go through that fire or whether they're saved from it, God is going to deliver them. He will either deliver them through a miraculous rescue, or he'll deliver them through death and into his presence. Either way, they're delivered. It's that confidence that lets them stand before the king of Babylon and say, look, we don't need to talk this out. God said not to worship any graven image, not to bow down to any idol. We're not going to do it. We obey God. And this might end miraculously with him saving us, or this might end with us dying in that furnace and being saved eternally. But either way, even if all that's left of us is a bunch of smoldering cremains, we're still not going to bow down to that idol. We obey God. We trust in God. We trust in God like Job did when Job said, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. And in truth, I think these three Hebrew men are probably more loyal to Nebuchadnezzar at this point than his wise men are. If they followed biblical principles, they would have obeyed the king in everything that they could, short of disobeying God. Yet, unsurprisingly, the king of Babylon becomes livid at their perceived defiance. In verse 19, it says, he is full of fury. And it says in verse 19, the form of his visage was changed. That's saying more than just the expression on his face altered. The word form there, you might want to circle the word form there in verse 19. It is the word tselem. We talked about that last week. It's the word for idol or image. The idol of his face changed. He commands the furnace to be heated seven times more. I think that just means, you know, this furnace, which is probably out there in the plain in order to smelt gold for this stupid statue, make that thing as hot as you can get it. And in verse 20, it says he commands the most mighty men that were in his army to restrain these three. Essentially, he's calling on the special forces, right? The Babylon's version of SEAL Team 6 gets deployed just because he can. And in verse 21, all three of them are bound and they are thrown into the top of the furnace, coats and socks and turbans and all. And the fire's so hot that according to verse 22, Nebuchadnezzar loses SEAL Team 6 in the process. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are supposed to die for disobeying the king. Instead, the executioners die for obeying the king. And finally, we see in verse 24 through 30, the God of heaven issues a verdict. It says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished, rose up in haste and spoke, and said to his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? Right? Well, this time, last chapter, he asked them something hard. This time, it's a math question. Can you count to three? Yes. Yes, it was three men, they say. True, O king. And he answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. And Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth in the midst of the fire. And the princes and governors and captains and king's counselors being gathered together saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was the hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. By the way, I really love verse 26. I have come to love it. Picture Nebuchadnezzar approaching this furnace and shouting for them to come out. You realize they wouldn't have done it otherwise. Right? Otherwise, they were just going to be like, yeah, we'll just stay in here in the flames where it's safe. But Nebuchadnezzar comes closer and he can see through the window of this furnace. Look, it probably looks like a gigantic pizza oven if you're trying to picture it. And he can see there are four figures in there. In the end of verse 25, some modern translations, instead of saying the image of the fourth is like the Son of God, they say the form of the fourth is like a son of the gods. And while it can be translated that way, and maybe that's what he meant, because this guy is polytheistic, right? He believes in many gods. Even if that's what he says, what he is saying is, look, the fourth person in there is divine. He identifies it as God's angel in verse 28. But as we try to decide, well, who is this fourth person? I just want you to understand, here's why that argument doesn't really mean much. Given what you know about Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapters 1, 2, and 3 so far, is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, going to be your go-to guy on issues of theology? Right? I do not need the pagan king of Babylon to tell me who this is. I can just read this and know that these men are cast into the furnace by the king, apparently as a visible display of the foolishness of worshiping an invisible God. And so that invisible God appears with them in the fire. As we go through Daniel, you're never going to hear a peep about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah again. And yet their faith speaks volumes. I'm convinced we do hear about them again in the New Testament. Not by name, but by implication. Listen to what Hebrews 11 says in the roll call of faith in verses 33 and 34. The writer talks about those faithful who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, and escaped the edge of the sword. And on he goes. So when the writer of Hebrews is arguing in favor of saving faith in Jesus Christ, he points back to the lion's den, and he points back to a flaming furnace, saying, I think we know who was in that fire. The writer of Hebrews is pointing to that fiery furnace and saying, this is why you should trust Jesus. And what would that mean for us unless this is a theophany? That's the word that we use for an appearance of God. More than that, it is a Christophany. It is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ, God in the flesh. I know who's with them in that fire. This is the same God in the flesh who appeared to Moses and left his face shining in the aftermath. This is the God who appeared to Abraham on the plains of Mamre. This is the God-man who wrestled with Jacob all night. This is the captain of God's army who appeared to Joshua outside of Jericho. I mean, if you asked Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to describe in a word, who was that with you in the fire? I can only imagine the word that they would use for it was Emmanuel, God with us. Who else but Jesus comes to earth for his people like this and saves them from the blistering flames, saves them so thoroughly? Verse 27 says they didn't have so much as a singed eyebrow or even the smell of smoke on their clothes. Listen, there's more that could be said here, but it seems wise to get to Jesus and then stop. I've got nothing to say that's better than him. These three men rejected the idolatry of this world because they wanted to obey God and trust in his promise of salvation. And they saw that promise of God come true, unmistakably displayed. And the issue for New Testament Christians then is this: because the world is going to offer indictments of you and pressure you to worship all the idols of their creation. And the only hope we have to stand against that coercion is hope that's in the Lord, hope that is in Jesus himself. There's nothing in this creation that is worth your worship. Only the Creator himself. Ultimate worship will never be found in building some tower or kneeling to a golden statue on the plains of Babylon. Ultimate worship is going to be found in eternity with those who kneel before Jesus, our Emmanuel. So that throughout eternity, when the heavenly orchestra plays, it really will be people from every kindred and tongue and people and nation who are bowing their knees to him.